There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Off the Hour, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are 4 days into the month of August. We are broadcasting from unceded Mohawk and Anishinaabe territory. You are tuned into The Avalanche, a special presentation of CKUT's Spoken Word Department. The Avalanche seeks to cover issues affecting those with disabilities. On today's show, part two of an interview with members of the Canadian chapter of T1 International, discussing the state of insulin in Canada upon insulin's 100-year anniversary of discovery. All that right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are listening to The Avalanche, where all abilities are welcome. If you would like to get involved, you can call 514-448-4041, extension 2593, or email spokenword@ckut.ca. You can also follow us on Twitter, @AvalancheCKUT.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is ongoing throughout Quebec. The combined effect of two doses ensures better efficacy of the vaccine, reducing the risk of getting and transmitting the virus. You'll also stay protected for a longer period of time. Coming to your appointment for the second dose of the vaccine is a must, whatever else is on your schedule. The second dose of vaccine is essential. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Are you a tenant in Montreal? Do you have questions about your rights? Your local housing committee can help. To find the housing committee for your neighborhood or for more resources, go to www.rclalq.qc.ca.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. On today's show, we have members of the Canadian chapter of T1 International to discuss the 100-year anniversary of insulin's discovery and the state of insulin in Canada. If you would like more information on the Canadian Insulin for All movement, you can follow them on Twitter @CanInsulin4, that's number 4, all. That's up now. So your organization has talked extensively about rationing. Would you be able to elaborate on what this term means?
So rationing means taking any amount of insulin that is less than what you need to optimally manage your diabetes and your blood sugar. And rationing can take a lot of different forms. So for some people, it means, for example, if I ate a food that required me to take 10 units of insulin, I might take 8 units of insulin instead. And the result would be that my blood sugar would run high after eating that food because I insufficiently treated my diabetes. And what that means is I may feel some impacts in the short term from allowing my blood sugar to run higher than it should. So I might feel thirsty or tired or irritable or hot. The problem is really with rationing, the long-term consequences of rationing. While I might just feel uncomfortable in the short term from using less insulin than I require to properly manage my blood sugar, over the long term, rationing insulin leads to the complications that are associated with diabetes. It leads to damage, multi-systemic whole body damage, particularly to blood vessels, but to all the systems in the body. And over time leads to organ damage and organ failure. And we have way increased risks of heart attack and stroke. And those result from a variety of causes. Oh, and our eyes, that's right, our eye health, because of course the blood vessels in the eye are really delicate. So rationing might mean underdosing for food that we eat, and it might happen occasionally, but it might happen more chronically. People also ration insulin in other ways. So rather than taking a full dose of insulin, so again, using that example, if I eat something that requires 10 units of insulin, usually I might take 8, and I might try to compensate for not using the full 10 units by exercising or drinking water or other means so that I can still try to keep my blood sugar in a good range. I may or may not have success in doing so. One of the other things that happens when people ration is they test their blood sugar less, because we all know the healthy blood sugar range. And we know the consequences of rationing will be almost immediately our blood sugar will be above the healthy range. And so people who ration don't see how badly things are going in terms of blood sugar management. And so people start to test less. And it's out of sight, out of mind. And then it's easier to have an unhealthy blood sugar range for a longer period of time when one starts the process of rationing.
I would assume that if people are rationing insulin, they're also rationing test supplies and so forth and so on as well.
I can definitely say I ration supplies as well. My prescription, when I've had prescription coverage, it's covered a month's supply, which costs around $300. And so it gives me 10, which I use one every 3 days, which is exactly a month, which means I can't have any accidents, which means my cord can't get caught on a door handle. It can't get kinked. I can't roll over it in the night. No accidents can happen whatsoever. That being said, I don't have any spares for if something happens. So I'm always in this fear that what if I push it one more day? That means if I keep my pump sight on one more day, push it to 4 days instead of three, that way I'll ration it. And next month I'll have that one free day just in case something happens. That being said, my pump sight can get infected. It's a simple thing that many diabetics do just because you want to plan ahead because you're going to have this disease for the rest of your life.
Within at least the online diabetes community, I guess I never really thought of it as rationing up until a few weeks ago when it was pointed out to me. But for CGMs, the Dexcom in particular, diabetics have found a way to make, originally Dexcom says that you can only use it for 10 days. It lasts for 10 days. You have to take it off, put a new one on. And diabetics have found a way around that to that you can like take the sensor in, take the transmitter out, wait, put it back in. Then you don't have to use another Dexcom. And I have been doing that since I've had the Dexcom because I was like, why wouldn't I, right? They're so expensive. If I can get an extra 10 days, 20 days, I can push it to 30 sometimes, then I get to save these the other CGMs that are still covered under my benefits in case something happens. What if I lose my job? What if my boyfriend loses his job? I don't have coverage. At least I have some to keep me through that. And then just a few weeks ago, someone was like, that seems dangerous. And it is, honestly, because the first 10 days are great. And then the next 10 days are okay. And then if I push it again, I find myself nervous, or I lose connection to it a lot more often. And I'm in a place where I don't have my test strips to just manually test my blood sugar. So it does get dicier and dicier the longer you leave this on. But like Britt said, I only get a certain amount covered under my insurance. So if one falls off early, or it fails, or the transmitter stops working, I panic that I'm not going to have enough supplies to cover me. So I will push that limit of keeping my transmitter on as long as I can, so I have some backups.
I've personally been fortunate that I've never had to ration my insulin, but like with my insulin pump, it's a different story. It's a little more expensive for me. I have rationed those supplies. I can completely understand why people ration their insulin. And I hope the listeners today can understand why Canadians get pushed to those limits, and how it's not just an infection site on your stomach that can get healed with antibiotics. It's long-term consequences. Your blood vessels start to burst in your eyesight. You start getting diabetic retinopathy, neuropathy, kidney disease, heart damage, like all these different complications. So it's just the one coverage of the various insulins and diabetic management supplies. But it's one preventative thing that could really save so many people.
Diabetes Canada, formerly known as the CDA, found that 57% of those with diabetes did not fully comply with their treatment plans. What would need to be changed in order for more people to access the care that they need?
I just want to say something about type 1 diabetes as opposed to maybe type 2, and maybe because I've had it for a long time. I don't have a prescribed treatment plan. Our disease changes. And we are given the tools by, at least I can only speak for myself, I've been given the tools by my endocrinologist and my diabetes educator and my nurse to make the changes to my own insulin needs based on what's happening in my life. So I'm not 100% sure what that means. I think that what not adhering to a treatment plan means rationing, but I'm not 100% sure.
It doesn't mean that. What it means is that people are not adhering to the recommendations and the clinical practice guidelines that are published by the association. And there's multi layers of problems with that. And it's not surprising that 57% aren't adhering to the treatment plan, because a lot of doctors don't follow the clinical practice guidelines either. And we probably should be slightly thankful that that's the case, because the practice guidelines, frankly, a lot of the recommendations in those guidelines are crap. These are funded by manufacturers, and they're sponsored by manufacturers, and they're marketing tools for their products, really, if you want to, you know, get right down to the nuts and bolts of it. But I also think that what you're talking about is completely right, that people with diabetes, insulin is one of the tools that provided people with diabetes with the ability to self-manage this condition. You don't need somebody sitting on your shoulder saying you must do this and you must not do that. People with diabetes need education. They need really good and effective tools to manage this condition. And the clinical practice guidelines do not provide that. And so the 57% figure that is used by the Diabetes Association, I mean, I don't even know why they would say that, except to try to make people feel guilty that they're not towing somebody else's line.
Yeah, what she said.
Colleen is absolutely right. There are things in the clinical practice guidelines that I have not personally found useful in the management of diabetes. And I do think that one of the things that we face as diabetic that probably influences access to care is the stigma around this disorder. And there's been a lot of stigmatization, unfortunately, even from healthcare providers, even those who specialize in the treatment of diabetes. And a statistic like this, that, and particularly the use of the word compliant, right? Like the idea that half of all people living with diabetes in Canada are failing to comply. Let's just look at this through the access lens. We know, for instance, that in Manitoba, if you are a low-income individual, you don't get pump coverage after the age of 18. So let's say you've done a really good job as a kid in Manitoba managing your type 1 diabetes, but you hit age 18, you didn't move into a six-figure income job, probably not. And so you no longer get to use a pump. Well, guess what? Your ability to manage your diabetes may reduce because you don't have a lifetime of managing it with multiple daily injections. You've been using a pump. There would be an adjustment period there. And it's possible that someone could see that person, analyze their diabetes management, let's say in their year where they turn 19 and no longer have access to a pump because of the financial burden of a pump and the supplies that go with it and the insulin, and decide that they are not compliant with their treatment plan. But that's not helpful. And something like universal pharmacare, something like nationwide coverage for the supplies that that diabetic would need. Maybe they move from Manitoba. Maybe they get a really good job in Ontario. Yay, their pump will be covered, but they're not going to get any coverage. That compliance is not an individual issue. Compliance, again, needs to be understood in the context of access to insulin and to the supplies needed to manage the disorder. And it doesn't tell the story to look at individual diabetics' outcomes or, I don't know, blood glucose readings. The story needs to be one of how do we as a nation support diabetics and make it easier or as easy as it can be for them to do the day in, day out, 24/7 management of diabetes. And for us, that starts with access. It starts with access to the right supports in a timely manner and being able to access the medication they need to manage the disorder.
Yeah, I do want to just add on to what Joanne was talking about in that, yeah, using the word comply is silly to me because I see my endocrinologist once every 6 months. So in between that, I go see them in January. By the time I see them in June, I've lived a whole 24 hour a day, every single day, no breaks ever with diabetes. So for then them to say, well, 57% of people did not comply with their treatment plans, you do something every single day, 24 hours a day, and aim to get the same outcome when you know that's not going to happen. And you tell me how often you're able to actually comply with whatever treatment plan you've been given. I think that's just like Colleen was saying, I think it's more just manufacturers trying to guilt people into feeling like they need to be better diabetics when there is no such thing as a bad diabetic or a good diabetic. We're just people trying to live with a disease.
But also, how do they know? You know, how does the Diabetes Association even know that this is the case? They're probably using markers like the HbA1c, which is a surrogate marker. I think that what people with diabetes need in order to develop a plan for themselves that works with their lives, with their health, their own health goals, and so forth. One, as Joanne said, they need access to all of the supplies that are required to achieve those goals. But they also need access to evidence that what they're doing is good, that it will not just give them a good A1C, you know, however many times a year that they get it, but that they are going to avoid long-term complications, that they're not going to go blind, they're not going to have their limbs amputated, their kidneys are going to be healthy, and so forth and so on. These are the end results of treatment that people want. And so compliance, I wouldn't say it's beside the point, but it is way, way, way down on any list of priorities that should be sort of, you know, on the screen for people with diabetes. People with diabetes need education. They need good evidence. They need to have confidence that the evidence that's being provided to them is true and not basically self-serving. The clinical practice guidelines that are used by the Diabetes Association have been criticized for many years because of the fact that they are based on very weak recommendations. They're not evidence-based recommendations. 50% of the recommendations are based on consensus amongst the expert panel that's enlisted by the association. And most of those people have financial links to the people who are funding the guidelines. So how can you develop any confidence in a treatment plan based on that? And I think that there is also, as Mallory also has said, a lot of resentment amongst people with diabetes that they are being treated like children if they're not in compliance with these plans that are based not on good, reliable evidence and are not meeting the objectives that people with diabetes themselves have.
I think it's also really important to note that diabetes is an autoimmune disorder, and autoimmune disorders usually come in clusters of two or more. So you're not only complying with just type 1 diabetes, usually you're complying with another illness. So try managing not only one horrible illness, but something else. It's a lot to build up on. You're usually dealing with your endocrinologist. And for me, I only see my endocrinologist once a year and for an hour if I'm lucky. Then that's their specialty, is that one illness, not the other autoimmune diseases that you have. So when you hear the word compliance, it's like you're not seeing the full picture. It's easy to say, yeah, the 57% when you're not even seeing the whole 100%.
I just want to thank you guys for like informing me about this topic and providing such like insights into it. I genuinely wasn't aware of the implications of that study, and specifically that they had outside influences.
I have one really good example. Sonia Sidhu, who is an Ontario MP, a Liberal MP, succeeded in putting through legislation, I think it was earlier this year, in fact, I know it was, to support a diabetes strategy, the development of a diabetes strategy in Canada. There are lots of problems with the approach that's being taken, but one of them is that they have established a stakeholder table, I guess is how they're describing it. And one of the people representing patients is a guy by the name of Russell Williams, who used to be the head of RX&D, which is the predecessor to the current Innovative Medicines IMC, which represents all of the largest pharmaceutical companies in Canada. It's a lobby group, and he used to be the president of that. And now he's representing Diabetes Canada, which is supposedly a patient advocacy organization, to participate in building a strategy to approach the whole issue of diabetes and what people with diabetes need, et cetera, et cetera. This is such corruption of the whole process. T1 International, which is the only advocacy group in Canada for people with diabetes that does not have financial links to the industry, was never invited to the table, was never, as I understand it, had contacted some of the members of that committee and never
acknowledged.
Yeah, I mean, it's just ridiculous. And so the involvement of the industry, not only in doing like the basic fundamental things, which is determining compliance, influencing treatment protocols and plans that are recommended by physicians to people with diabetes, et cetera, but also at the public policy level, the industry has way, way too much involvement in insulin. And our government somehow cannot screen out these very, very high levels of conflict of interest. And I would go further, actually, I would describe it as corruption. And this harms people. It isn't just that it's ethically repugnant, it also harms patients and it undermines our long-term security and so forth and so on. So it's a very, very complicated picture. But the dismantling of some of these interactions and relationships between our elected officials and policymakers and representatives of the industry who come in many, many guises, including through the Diabetes Association, these are things that need to be really exposed in a much stronger way. And politicians like Sonia Sidhu, I would name her specifically, should be held to account and explain why she is meeting with the pharmaceutical industry and the Diabetes Association, the Diabetes Canada, without bringing in people who are genuine voices for the community and who do not have these financial conflicts of interest.
So are there countries who provide exemplary care and coverage for healthcare that you would like Canada to emulate?
I mean, almost anywhere in the world could do it better than Canada. And I mean, in the wealthy countries like Canada. We had a member of this group originally lived in Morocco, and she shared with us that for her, access to insulin meant walking down the block, going into the nearest hospital, asking for insulin, needles, supplies of all the kinds that she needs, and walking out with them for free in Morocco. Like, Canada has no excuse in all of the other wealthy nations in the world, whether they have universal pharmacare or not, although most of them do. All of them do a better job of providing people with diabetes access to insulin and disease management supplies, medications, endocrinologist appointments, specialist, you know, appointments for any of the complications or consequences of diabetes. They're all accessible in all of the other countries that are the equivalent of Canada. And there's really no excuse for how poor the coverage for all of the things that diabetics need to live in Canada.
I would say Britain has a pretty good system. I use animal insulin, so access to animal insulin is, of course, important for me. The UK actually has a manufacturer based there that makes animal insulin, so that's good. The UK also, because of that contribution from that manufacturer, they have a much broader range of options for people with diabetes than Canada does. Although we have pork insulin available in Canada, we import it. We don't make it here. The one problem with almost all countries is that they are dependent on imports. So if you look at Africa, large parts of Asia, and so forth, their access to insulin is very problematic because they don't have any manufacturers on that entire continent of Africa. So, but all countries are vulnerable in the same way. We're all dependent on three global manufacturers. And so in that sense, Canada's in the same boat with most other countries. The coverage of insulin and supplies is weaker here, as Joanne said. And one of the reasons is because those other countries go to the table to bargain with manufacturers to bring the price down. So if you look at, I think the average cost of insulin in the UK now is probably about 35 or 36 pounds for a 10 mil vial. And which I'm not sure what that is now. It's probably about $60, I think, or something like that, $50 or $60. And so there are no out-of-pocket payments by patients for that. And because the government is footing the bill, they will go to the table and do a hard bargain with the manufacturers, which our government won't do that because they're not paying the full bill. We are.
We also had somebody speak to our group who just moved back to Canada from Scotland. Right? It was from Scotland. And so not only was insulin all covered, but all of the supplies around our insulin pumps and our CGMs, all of that was covered. None of it was out of pocket. But they just put in an order and they had it delivered to their house. None of that is covered in its entirety like it is in the UK.
So I think there's a really large misconception here in Canada that our healthcare system is actually a pharmacare system to the rest of the world. And I think it's because we're seen as a rare golden standard compared to our US neighbors. But Jen and I have actually been connecting with Canadian doctors for Medicare. Mm-hmm. And I was actually listening to one of their presentations, and they compared Canada to Australia, New Zealand, Norway, Sweden, and United Kingdom. And they're actually really similar to Canada in that they have a single payer healthcare insurance system. And it's similar to our Canadian Medicare. However, these systems through their own single payer prescription drug plans as well. And they have like relatively low co-payments for their patients. So I think though, if you want to look at countries that are similar and are doing it the right way, those are really the countries to target. If you check out their social media, so Canadian Doctors for Medicare, they just did a presentation though, and they'll tell you just how much money Canadians will save if they do include a pharmacare system.
We also have the second highest drug prices in the OECD. And so that also is a reflection of the weak bargaining position that's taken by Canadian governments in respect of the industry. We just do not bargain low prices. And so it's not only that those other countries have better coverage, it's also that they're overall spending less, much less on drugs than we are, because they have stronger price control systems. The U.S. outpaces everybody in terms of drug costs, and they don't have price controls. And we can see what the difference is between Canada and the U.S. in terms of the price of insulin. You have Americans prior to COVID coming to Canada to buy insulin because it's so much cheaper here. The only difference between Canada and the U.S. is that we have a system of price controls, which is weak, but it's way better than what exists south of the border. So Brittany's right. We often think that we're a lot better off than our American counterparts, and we are, but we are also very vulnerable. The industry is opposed to price controls in Canada, and they are very, very aggressively lobbying to weaken those controls. So we're not that far behind the U.S. in that respect.
I actually think globally it's the U.S., Japan, and then Canada for pricing.
I think it goes up and down. Sometimes we're second, sometimes Switzerland is second, sometimes Japan is second.
Okay. And that being said, our group, we just expanded to be Canada Insulin for All, but the province of Quebec is a little bit different in how you guys have your own mandatory private healthcare system or insurance. Yeah, RAMQ. So we would love for someone to educate us. If someone's out there and they want to let us know what's going on in your province and just let us know how Canadian diabetics in Quebec are dealing with things, if you could reach out to us.
I also hope that people listening to the show who have insight on this specifically in terms of T1 care, reach out to you guys.
Awesome.
So the original patent for insulin was sold to the University of Toronto for $1 in order to help as many people as possible. Over the last 100 years, however, insulin can still be inaccessible. How did the cost and accessibility of insulin evolve over the course of its history?
There were a number of factors that helped maintain a low cost internationally on the price of insulin. One was the conditions that were maintained by the University of Toronto when they granted a license to manufacturers in other countries to make insulin for their own domestic population. And the license was conditioned on the manufacturer ensuring that the price for insulin would continue to be very low, that there would not be large profits built into the price. And so as a consequence, you know, countries all over Europe, Australia, New Zealand, they all complied with these conditions on the license. The only country that didn't was the United States, and Eli Lilly negotiated a separate deal with the University of Toronto, which the co-discoverers and the university were not happy about. But Eli Lilly had, they had greater capacity to produce insulin in mass quantities. So at the time, of course, everybody who knew that insulin had been discovered wanted to get insulin. So there was an accommodation for Eli Lilly at that time. So for many, 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 many years, we produced insulin in Canada within the public system. So Connaught Labs was a public lab that was set up by the University of Toronto, and they made insulin and supplied it at cost, or in some cases for free, to provinces who were able to distribute it to people in their own provinces. And so the cost of insulin was very, very low. I was diagnosed in 1969, and at that time, insulin cost about $1.10 per 10 mil vial. And there were different types. There was beef, there was pork, there was a beef-pork mix, and there were many, many different types of insulin. But roughly, it was, I would say, between $1 and $3 per vial. In the late 1970s, the price started to go up, and at the time that the price of insulin began to go up, there was also a push to commercialize the market, and this came from a lot of different companies. Connaught at that time was still a public manufacturer, and so Canadians benefited from that public manufacturer until really the late 1980s. We were out of sync with a lot of other countries. The price of insulin in Canada was lower than just about any other country on the planet because we were making it domestically and was being provided still within the terms of those original terms that existed in the 1920s, at cost, no profit, et cetera, et cetera. Connaught was privatized in the mid-1980s, and it was eventually acquired by what is now Sanofi. Because of that loss, we not only lost the control over the manufacture of insulin, we also lost control over the price. And so that is the story in Canada, and it isn't radically different from what happened in other countries. Canada was a leader in insulin manufacturing and also research in regard to the different types of insulin. We introduced a lot of the newer types of animal insulins were also developed in Canada. So we were a real global leader in that sense. We no longer are, as you know, people have mentioned previously, we're dependent on three corporations, and they control access, they control price, they control the type of insulin that's made, they control whether or not they will continue to supply insulins that have been introduced over the years, and we have no ability to control them. So all of these things had a dramatic impact on our access and also internationally, because companies won't supply a country if people are not able to pay the price that they demand. So that's basically it in a nutshell.
So with the potential of a federal election being called this year, how can we make issues regarding the status of healthcare national priorities?
For people who don't necessarily lean on our healthcare system as of right now, I think the first step is just making people realize that we do not have universal healthcare, that we don't just go into a pharmacy and pick up our insulin or our supplies for free. There is a cost associated with that, that we don't receive these things for free through our healthcare system. We have to lean on our private insurance companies and our disability tax credits and other programs, social programs set up through the government to be able to afford to just survive. I think that's the most important thing, is just spreading the word that we don't have universal healthcare. People really, and I'm guilty of it, before I was diagnosed, I was like, oh, I live in Canada. Everything's free here. We're great. And I would say that to my American friends and my Australian friends, like, it's great. We're totally fine here. And then it was a really big slap in the face to realize that, no, that's not true. There is a huge financial burden on people who have autoimmune disorders, chronic illnesses, any sort of illnesses. And I think, at least for me, that's the most important thing, is just we have to make these issues clear and apparent to people who don't lean on the healthcare system right now.
I think one of the things that the COVID pandemic has done is brought Canadians' awareness to our reliance on the healthcare system and that our lives depend on it. And it may be through that dependency that we've all had on doctors and nurses and hospitals and long-term care providers and all of the people who've had to delay or wait for surgical intervention, you know, health and disease management of all kinds during the pandemic. I hope that that's increased the awareness in Canada in general, that our healthcare system is something we all rely on to live, and that access to that healthcare system is inequitable. I can better access an endocrinologist here in Toronto than can someone who lives in the Yukon. But we're both Canadians and we both pay our taxes. The geography should not determine our health or our access to the kind of to medication, to diabetes management technology. And I hope that now that it looks like the Liberal government is planning to call a federal election, as my mom joked, Justin shaved the beard, so, you know, he must be getting serious now. If he is serious, and if he's serious in following through on the promise that his government has been making since some of the people, the members in our group with type 1, before they were born, you know, like, it's time. It's beyond time. And during a year in which everybody felt vulnerable in terms of their health, I hope there's a recognition that Canadians can't make it on their own, whether it's people with diabetes or people with other health conditions or people who haven't needed the healthcare system yet. The reason we have a public healthcare system is because we don't expect people to make it on their own. And this is the time for our country to follow through on the promise of pharmacare, to actually finally maybe have a universal healthcare system that doesn't disadvantage people with lower income or who are unable to overcome some of the barriers to access, right? It shouldn't matter how much money you have in your pocket. It shouldn't matter where you live. It shouldn't matter the nature of your disorder. If you have a healthcare condition and you live in Canada, you should get access to what you need to manage that condition. And Canadians already believe in this. I don't think we need to convince the Canadians. Like, everybody wants this for themselves, for their neighbor, for the person they're going to be in 30 years. Everybody wants this. So it is how to raise awareness. I don't even think we need to raise awareness or raise a desire amongst the Canadian public for it. The people who don't seem to be on board are the people who are in government. And so that's where our advocacy in T1 International is going to be focused. Prior to an election, during an election, after an election, we need universal pharmacare. And our chapter is going to continue to find the allies that exist in Canada who also want universal pharmacare, you know, the Physician for Medicare, and lots of different kinds of other organizations, labor organizations, large unions for healthcare workers. Everybody recognizes the need. And stay tuned, because we have plans.
I just think that historically, like, healthcare and pharmacare have been such a important, like, Liberal and NDP priority. And I just want to make sure that people, no matter who your party is, like, reach out to your elected officials and let them know that this is important to you. If you're like 1 in 5 people in Canada who are rationing your medication, you're not taking your prescribed treatment plans, like, let your MPs know. Maybe that's a little personal, but like, if it's not too personal for you, let them know that your health is at risk. This isn't something that should be happening. Canadians need a pharmacare plan. And I think the first step is contacting them. Let them know. Let them know that they don't have your vote if they don't vote for pharmacare. Another important thing is that our chapter on social media, we break down all the bills. We know it's confusing, but we do graphics that break down each bill, letting you know the main point, and then also a summary at the end on who voted. So that way, you can hold them accountable. Give them a call and say, like, why? Why didn't you vote for pharmacare? There's really no excuse to not stay informed on this issue, because it's so important, not only for your health, but for your friends and family. With, like, the Canadian population, with so many of the baby boomers aging, and then obviously with the COVID pandemic, health is such an important priority. That being said, we have a link tree on all of our social media platforms. It's super easy. You just have to click on it and you can find out who your MP is as well. You just have to put in your postal code and you can reach out to them. I know a lot of people just find it to be too much work. We're making it really simple. Just let them know that you want pharmacare. And hopefully, just listening to this, you understand just a need for diabetics. Maybe it's not impacting you that you don't have access to insulin, like something we all need, but that's something simple that you can do to help us all out. You can contact us, and of course we can link you to it. But if you just type in www.ibelieverourcommons.com, usually a few days after any of the votes, or it pulls up the results on who voted and what the results were.
Are there any projects with T1 International or your local chapters that you would like to promote?
Yes.
Where should we begin?
I think we should go back to what Colleen was saying about the diabetes framework, Brittany.
Okay. So as we mentioned at the beginning of this interview, we've grown really quickly from Toronto to Ontario, now nationally, to represent all of Canada. We're kind of focusing on a few topics. One of our main focuses is this bill C-237. We always get confused. A national framework for diabetes. And this is a private member's bill put forward by Sonia Sidhu.
The bill has already passed, but now the hard work begins. And the all Party Diabetes Caucus has the Canadian Diabetes or Diabetes Canada on it and GDRF Canada on it. But we would like to be a part of that all-party diabetes caucus as the only patient-led non-pharma money part of that. We want our voices heard. And so we want on that all-party caucus. And so that's one of our main focuses is how do we get on that all-party caucus and how do we get our voices heard? And so we've made a couple of friends around social media, like the Canadian Doctors for Medicare, and we're trying to find people that will support us, that who are not necessarily patients of type 1 diabetes, but people who support people with diabetes to help us get our voices heard. So that's one of our major projects over the rest of this year. The other thing is that we realized that we became the Canadian Insulin for All chapter very quickly. And we're very cognizant of the fact that we are still very heavily representing Southern Ontario, which we know is not the whole country. And so we are trying to get our name out there and trying to reach out to other diabetes advocacy groups across the country. We want to become one. We want to get as many voices heard. We don't only want to talk to type 1 diabetics. We want to talk to anybody who's insulin dependent. We also want to talk to parents of type 1 diabetics because those are people who are advocating for their children. And I don't know anybody who does that more than people who are advocating for their children. We want to make sure that we are talking for everyone. Those are two of our main projects. And then again, obviously, as we've stated, PharmaCare.
We're also really focused on getting coverage for diabetic pump supplies and CGM coverage. Like we've mentioned throughout this discussion, we believe that access should be equal for all Canadians, no matter your geographic location. That being said, right now, CGM coverage only exists in 4 of the 13 provinces and territories in Canada, and it's limited by age and a variety of requirements. If you have more information on the province or territory you live in, we'd love for you to reach out to us. Let us know how we can help you progress of the state of access in your area. It'd be great to hear. We are also trying to promote everything on our social media channels. If you enjoy making graphics or have additional information to share with everyone about things that are going on in your province and territory, we may be neglecting that area just because we don't have many people from your province or territory. We'd love to welcome you to our group, whether or not you want to join our social media committee or not. Our parent organization on September 18th and 19th, T1 International, is hosting a workshop based on their 100th year anniversary campaign, From Gift to Greed. This will be a celebration of the centennial of the synthesization of insulin, and we will be presenting at it. So we're excited to be giving a presentation on the Canadian perspective. This will be without the light of
Big Pharma. No light of Big Pharma is going to be on it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. That's an opportunity for our chapter to connect with other chapters from around the world of T1 International and to meet with other advocates and talk about campaigns that they have running in their country and campaigns that we have running here. Again, we've talked about the fact that both inside of Canada and outside of Canada, there are perceptions about what people with diabetes have access to here in Canada in terms of insulin and other tools to manage diabetes, and a lot of misconceptions, right? So we are looking at that presentation as an opportunity to share with other people from around the world the challenges in terms of access that Canadians have, that rationing of insulin is going on in Canada right now, the birthplace of insulin. It's on our money, but it's still costing us a lot of money to manage this disorder. So we're really hoping to increase awareness amongst other people who are members of T1 International, but amongst public in general. And we're hoping once we have been able to share that presentation in mid-September with the rest of the T1 International organization, that there might be opportunities to work together with chapters in other countries, particularly our American cousins. And also then maybe to be able to use that presentation as a way to talk to other organizations in Canada that are currently trying to encourage the government in power to bring about universal pharmacare.
So our group mission at Canada Insulin for All is to raise awareness of the issues Canadians face accessing insulin, medical devices, medications needed to effectively manage their disability. We aim to educate the public of issues those with diabetes face, to advocate for and elevate their voices of people with all forms of diabetes across Canada, too, and to advocate with all levels of government for legislative change, namely universal pharmacare, and to equitable access to diabetes medical devices, regardless of where one lives in Canada. All Canadians deserve equal access. We were Type 1 International's first chapter, and we are proud of our work, our advocacy, and our community we've built. We are a patient-run, patient advocacy group, and we are very proud to say we accept no pharma funding. We are actively looking for new members all over Canada. We are trying to create a social media group that provides educational content that represents all of Canada. So if your listeners would like to follow us on social media for more information, you can find us on Facebook at Canada Insulin for All, on Twitter at CAN in capitals, Insulin for All, Instagram at CAN Insulin for All, Linktree CAN Insulin for All, email CanadaInsulinForAll@gmail.com.
Cool. Thank you so much.
This was great. So, I mean, we really, really want to thank you for this opportunity.
from his hand, the touch of a lover I never believed in the rubber. Nobody told me nothing was mine, nothing was mine. Taken was all there was, looting at dawn, looting at dusk. Hold up the gates for the world to last. And all I saw was the dust I kicked up.
Okay, I gotta let you go. I have to get my Lake Magog vaccine.
Your Lake Magog vaccine?
Yeah, you know, I'm really looking forward to having the whole family to the cottage for my annual cookout.
Smart move. I'm gonna ask for the Montreal vaccine. I miss those last-minute get-togethers with my buddies.
Nice. Well, I gotta run. I don't think it protects against lateness.
Each vaccination brings us closer to these moments. Follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book an appointment at quebec.ca/COVID vaccine. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. What? Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. You were just listening to a panel with Canadian members of T1 International. If you would like more information and to keep up to date with them, you can follow CanInsulin4, that's the number 4, all, on Twitter. And that completes this episode of The Avalanche, a special edition of Off the Hour, airing every Wednesday from 5 to 6. To stay up to date with Avalanche news, check out our Twitter at AvalancheCKUT. Thank yous are due to all those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. If you would like more information on anything you heard tonight, or would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact The Avalanche at avalancheckut.ca or CKUT's spoken word department at 514-448-4041, extension 2593, or email spokenword@ckut.ca. Stay tuned for Jose, that's up next.
The Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We are dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. With that in mind, we would like to let you know that we have a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters. In fact, we have two phone lines. You can call us Collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviere de Prairie Prison by calling 514-876-3748. We also have a number for non-collect calls. That number is 438-337-8423. Feel free to call that number and leave a message for us with news to share on the show or an audio message for your loved ones inside.
The FM band is from 88 megahertz up to 108.
You've got this frequency. We're going to call you CKUT. You've got this frequency, 98.3. That frequency is what you're picking up when you tune that radio.
Very impressive.
You can sit on the moon and it looks like they pick up CKUT, clear as a bell.
Fascinating. Your analysis seems logical.
CKUT is on the air.
C'est le 4 août 2021, vous écoutez Audio Smut sur les ondes de CKUT 90.3 FM.
Je m'appelle Mycelium, et pour le mois d'août, je vais explorer le mythe de la nymphe, en concordance aussi avec la question sociale de l'inceste. Je savais pas exactement comment parler de ça adéquatement, en dedans d'une heure, de façon vraiment purement théorique. Donc, je me suis dit qu'une mise en contexte culturel serait une bonne comme porte d'entrée dans ce sujet-là. J'ai choisi des œuvres qui sont extrêmement connues, que probablement la plupart des auditeurs vont avoir au moins un point de connexion avec ces œuvres-là, pour bien justement aller souligner le fait que la question de l'abus sexuel en enfance et particulièrement peut-être la figure de la nymphe et l'inceste parfait, celui que je vais explorer aujourd'hui, est comme complètement imbriqué dans la culture d'une façon qui est historiquement fusionnelle. Puis je fais une certaine étude comparative dans le sens où j'analyse ces œuvres-là en conversation les unes avec les autres, même si elles viennent de contextes géopolitiques